WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Edward Conlon, writes about what it's like to be a New York City cop in his new memoir, Blue Blood. He joined the NYPD in 1995 and has patrolled housing projects, worked in the Street Narcotics Enforcement Unit, and is now a detective in the Bronx. He reflects on crime, danger, and death with the skill of a fine novelist. The best-selling crime writer Ed McBain described Blue Blood as a splendid recounting of Conlon's long years with the NYPD, a book that resonates with a shattering ring of truth and reads surprisingly like a novel. Conlon first wrote about his work in a series of autobiographical pieces for The New Yorker, published under a pseudonym. Let's start with a short reading from his book, Blue Blood.
When you arrest someone, it's like a blind date. You spend a few hours with a stranger, a few feet apart, saying, "Tell me about yourself." You ask, "How much do you weigh?" And, "Are you a gang member?" "Really? Which one?" So maybe I haven't been on a blind date for a while. But you do hold hands for a few minutes as you take prints, rolling each fingertip individually, then four fingers together, flat, and the thumb flat at the bottom of the card. Three cards for adults, four for juveniles. You coat a plastic plank lightly with ink, rolling it from a pad, then take each finger, relax, and roll it on the plank and then on the card. A lot of people try to help you, rolling the fingers themselves, which usually smudges the impression. Sometimes that's their intent. Crackheads often don't have usable prints, with fingers burnt smooth from gripping the red-hot glass pipe. Junkies coming down can go into a whole body cramp and have hands as stiff as lobster claws. Perps collared for robbery or assault might have bruised, swollen, and bloody fingers. You try to be gentle, and you wear latex gloves.
That's Edward Conlon reading from his new memoir, Blue Blood, about his life as an officer on the NYPD. You know, it sounds like there's a surprising intimacy with the people that you arrest. Do you feel that way usually?
Well, sometimes you spend a lot of time with them, and if it goes right, you spend even more time. I mean, every time you arrest someone, you're going to spend hours in the cell and hours bringing them down and hours after that talking to them to try and get them to talk about what they did and what else they might know about what other people are doing. So you try and be closer to them sometimes than is in their best interest.
You usually also see people at their worst, at their most violent or their most vulnerable. In fact, I'm going to ask you to tell the story of the elderly woman who you walked in on a call, and she was basically, she was alive, but she was decomposing in her own bed.
Yeah, that was really just about the most terrible thing that I've seen. There was an aided case, which is a medical call. We would escort EMS into the projects when they came. It was called an aided case. And in this one, I wasn't sure what the original call was. I was just one of the officers who went along with the ambulance. And we went in, and it was this big apartment. It was a housing project, but I think it was a 3 or 4 bedroom apartment. So it just had a huge feel to it. You were walking down the halls, and there's room after room after room. And finally, when we got to the last bedroom, there was what we know is the DOA smell, the smell of a dying body. And the EMS was already there, and a couple of the paramedics were around the body, and they were crying, which was not something you usually see, because, you know, these are people who see bodies in pieces and dead babies, really, as a matter of course. So this had to be something exceptional. And it was. In this case, there was this old woman who was on a bed, and it was just a plastic sheet, kind of bare. And she was emaciated. I mean, she was once a kind of heavy woman, but she was really just looked deflated, the way the skin hung on her. And so they were lifting her off that plastic sheet, and then she started to moan. And it was, there were maggots all over her, and maggots only eat dead tissue. So this woman literally was dying bit by bit. And she'd been left there. And the terrible, really terrible thing was that she didn't live alone. She had a granddaughter, I believe, and also her daughter, who were in and out. And it was the granddaughter who'd called the cops. And we weren't maybe as polite as we might have been, because she was just took this kind of pouty teenager tone. I said, well, why didn't you call the cop? Why didn't you call the ambulance? And she said, well, I'm the one who did. So why didn't you give her anything to eat? She said she wasn't hungry. Well, why didn't you call an ambulance before then? Oh, my mother said not to. And this family had kept her there because the checks went through her. She got all kinds of subsidies for the apartment, for the grandkids, for everybody. She was where the money came from. So they held on to her as long as they could.
What does it do to you to always see people at their worst?
Well, people don't call the cops when they're happy. That's sort of the fact of the job. So it can skew your perspective a little bit because you just either something terrible has usually happened, whether it's your house has been broken into or a relative has died. You just see pretty much the worst all the time when you're responding to a job. And that's actually why I liked walking a beat so much, especially earlier in the career, because you got to see the ordinary life and the better parts of people's lives. Just walking around and people would say hello and they were happy to see you most of the time.
After working as a beat cop, you worked for the Street Narcotics Enforcement Unit. What was the job?
That was to catch drug dealers. We through what's called observation sales. We would go to a rooftop or into an apartment and look out the window and watch the corner, watch the lobby or wherever they were selling. It was pretty much crack and heroin in the South Bronx at the time. And it was interesting work. You'd have somebody in the observation post or OP, and you would just watch to see what happened. We knew most people. We knew most of the places. And you would see the guys in the corner, and somebody would come up and buy, and you'd tell somebody in the catch car to go pick them up a couple blocks away. And it was the other way the police department does it, though that kind of operations, is called buy and bust, where an undercover makes a buy and people swoop in afterwards and pick up the dealer. But this is more, we didn't have undercovers in the precinct level, and this is more amateur in a way and interesting in another way because you saw everything. You just got to see how the whole set worked, and it was almost like a nature show, you know, in the felony ecology of the streets. You would see who was the lookout and who was the manager, and, you know, if this crackhead came up and they might have a guy on a bicycle, follow him for a block or two to see if we were watching. And it was sometimes you felt like you were, you know, the boss the casino watching all the watching all the tables to see whose luck was too good and which guy was standing there purposely and which guy was making a move and which guy is a guy you should keep on watching.
How did you get to watch without being seen yourself?
Well, sometimes we worked in plain clothes and you could just, you know, we were a pretty mixed unit, Jamaican guy, an Irish guy, Italian guy, a black woman, and a couple of Puerto Rican guys who were... One Puerto Rican, one was Shorter Rican, as he was called by the other Puerto Rican because he was a little bit shorter than the rest of us. But we could sometimes, you know, when you fit into a neighborhood like this, there's, you know, the black and Hispanic cops had obviously a lot more freedom of movement than the white guys. But sometimes you could, you know, just get on housing authority work or coveralls and walk in the building with a mop, or you could get a Con Ed helmet and march down the street with like that. But or, you know, sometimes if I was in uniform, I would just walk into a building with a big bag of Dunkin' Donuts. So they didn't expect me to be working too hard. But you get in, you set up, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait. Sometimes it's very busy, and sometimes it's slow for a while.
You know, I so often see cops or security guards whose job is to just watch all day, and I think, how do they keep focused? How did you keep focused when you were just observing?
Well, you have a point to it. I don't think I could do that if I just had to stand there and watch for anything. But when you have to watch for something in particular, and you know that something is going to happen, or you have to figure out why something isn't happening. Is it because they're out of drugs? Is it because they heard a cop car go by two or three blocks away? And is that related to them, or is there some robbery a couple of blocks away? Or did narcotics just come through? And are they afraid? And are they right? and was the last customer who just came up to them, was he really an undercover? Were they right or wrong about that? So as long as they're out there and you see them and you know the way it goes on this corner and you know the people are going to be there, there's a point to watching.
My guest is Edward Conlon. His new memoir is called Blue Blood. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Edward Conlon. He's a police officer with the New York Police Department, now a detective, and he also writes. He's written for The New Yorker and now has a new memoir, which is called Blue Blood. You've said that one of the more dangerous things, in your line of work is when you have to bust down a door and you're the first person in and you really don't know what awaits you on the other end. Can you tell us one of the stories of how that played out for you?
Well, doing search warrants really are, to me, the most exciting part of a job, because as much homework and research you do about what's on the other side of the door, you don't know what's on the other side till you knock it down. And there may be guns there, maybe drugs, there may be, even more frightening, there may be old people or kids who aren't supposed to be there. So those, when people talk about the most dangerous and difficult part of the job, I mean, they've been in some awful situations. But the things that frighten me most are the idea of something like that happening, where we did one search warrant where we had the guy identified, and he was on parole for robbery. He was moving a fair amount of heroin. He was supposed to be living alone, and we hit the door, and he wasn't there. There was just this elderly Spanish woman who began clutching her heart and hyperventilating, and So immediately called for an ambulance, but we're there. And she said that she lived alone. She didn't even have any children. And so we're really, really concerned. And we called for an ambulance and then saw a lot of men's clothes around. So we knew she wasn't telling the truth either. So I went through the closet that had all the men's clothes in it and began taking things apart and found a big brick of heroin and a brand new .45 in a shoebox. So you never know how right your informant is or how wrong he is until you're on the other side of the door. And once we found the heroin and the gun, the old lady felt a lot better. she began speaking in a more calm and normal voice and claimed that the couple of $1,000 that we found was really hers and it wasn't her son's. And then the son actually came back because he saw the ambulances and was afraid that his mother was sick. And though she was feeling much better, he walked in and said, "Who's she to you?" And he said, "He's my mother. You live here?" "Yeah." "Congratulations, you're under arrest."
When you make an arrest, you not only try to get information from the person you've arrested, you often try to get them to inform on other people. And maybe to be a more long-term snitch. Can you tell us something about the best snitch you ever had?
Let's see. Well, the ones who are still working, obviously I can't give up too much about, but they tend to be the ones that I've had the longest relationships with were just sort of inconspicuous and sad people who could move around a neighborhood and never attract any suspicion, really, because dealers look down on junkies and they give them what they want and they move along, and certain kinds of neighborhood characters can move in just about any of the spots that are out there. Then there are the more one woman who we called Saul was another one of these neighborhood people who'd been around forever and knew everyone. And I think partly because she was a woman, she wasn't taken as a threat in the same way a guy could be. But she was also kind of a serious criminal herself when she was younger. She would do gunpoint stick-ups. And she would, I think her mother did too, but the whole family was involved with crime and drugs. And she was just pretty ruthless. I mean, she once gave up her nephew who was wanted for a stabbing, but going to a family party and claiming to be calling a taxi, but instead calling the precinct and say, "Okay, I need that pickup at 123 Smith Street," and as a prearranged signal. So not a lot of sentiment involved in this kind of business.
What can you offer in return to someone who gives you information?
Two things, money and freedom.
How much money do you have to offer somebody for that?
Well, it varies. I mean, when I was on patrol and in SNU, it was pretty much all out of pocket. In narcotics, they would pay them basically $100 for a search warrant. Now the city is putting a lot of money.
Does that mean $100 for enough information to get a search warrant? Is it
for a search warrant that worked out well, where we got something.
Uh huh.
But now the city's giving out $1,000 for a gun. And that's a program that we've gotten a lot of mileage out of. If you know anybody who has a gun, you know, you call it in and you work it out with a detective to make sure that it's got. You get $1,000, which is has worked pretty well.
What do you like about that system?
Well, it puts a real incentive to get the gun off the street. And people may be fond of their friends or not too fond of their ex-boyfriend or whoever has the gun. But it's moved a good amount of guns off the street.
Do you respect your snitches? Do you think they're doing the right thing?
Well, you never know what you would do yourself if you were forced into their particular corner. Some of them are pretty cold-blooded, but some of them are just sad. They're junkies or they've just decided for one reason or another that they're not going to do the time. They'd rather be with their kids or rather be with their wives or rather be with their families, even though they haven't spent a lot of time till now with them. But they think maybe in the future they'll get to make up for it.
You write that in some ways the cop code and the criminal code reflect each other in a funhouse mirror. And you're talking there in part about what respect means to the cop and to the criminal. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, respect, I mean, they do resemble each other in a certain way, but I really don't know what respect means sometimes in out in the street in the ghetto. I mean, there was one drug dealer when I was a beat cop. I locked him up once or twice, but I'd see him out there and I'd nod to him, and just to show that I saw him there. But he used to tell me, you know, you're all right now, you're all right, Conlon, you respect me, which was just not true. I didn't respect him. But, I mean, I treated him fairly, and I didn't arrest him when he didn't have drugs. If that was his idea of respect, well, so it goes. But sometimes it means a lot less. It just means that you're not attacking me on sight whenever you feel like it. You know, that's not my idea of respect. But, cops, when especially when they're out in the street, when they are walking alone, walking beats, they do have to make sure that it's understood that people won't even begin to try that. I mean, that people won't jump them, that people won't come after them. So in that sense, a sense of respect, of keeping your distance because you know you're going to get worse than what you give, that has to be communicated.
How hard was it for you to get respect from people on the street?
I don't know. I mean, I walked there. I was there for a couple of years, so people got to know me.
You took over the housing project now?
Yeah, yeah. And also, I mean, I was 30 years old when I started, so, I mean, I wasn't a kid, really. I didn't really have much of a chip on my shoulder. I'd talk to people and say hello and walk by. But, you know, you do get into these confrontations, especially if there's a group of guys. And that was the kind of classic and exhausting part about of antagonism of the beat. You walk by a couple of guys who may be drinking beers or maybe playing the radio. And you walk by and say, listen, guys, you got to keep it down. We've had complaints. And maybe you have and maybe you haven't. But, you know, you will if they keep going. So it's just sort of a test to see if they're going to respect you, because you've given them some respect. You've talked to them nicely and asked them for some accommodation, but not to break up the party completely. And you'll see how that goes. And maybe they will, and maybe they'll keep it down, and they say, all right, well, thanks, take care. Or usually, very often, somebody will mouth off, you know, F you, what are you going to do about it? And then that's where the respect comes in. You've got to turn around and talk to them. And maybe they'll back down again and say they're sorry, and maybe the guys will jump in and say, don't mind him, he's a little drunk. As long as there's a reaction that shows respect, then, you know, you can say, okay, guys, take it easy, and move along. But otherwise,
but it sounds, you know, that's when... It sounds like a lot of people are just going to challenge you. you know.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes you can laugh and ignore it, and other times it's a kind of threat that you have to address. I mean, not in an angry way, but just to stay there and show that you're not going to go away. Not certainly not because they want you to.
Edward Conlon's new memoir is called Blue Blood. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Edward Conlon. His new memoir, Blue Blood, is about his work with the New York Police Department. Before becoming a detective, he patrolled housing projects in the South Bronx and worked in the Street Narcotics Enforcement Unit. Part of your memoir deals with what you did after September 11th, and you were assigned to go to the Fresh Kills landfill, where all the remains were sent, and to be one of the people sifting through the remains, looking for bones, body parts, and personal possessions in the dust and rubble. I'd like you to read a short excerpt from that chapter.
There was everything there and nothing. The dirt wasn't even dirt, not earth, but a blend of ash and dust. Concrete walls, wooden desks, the people who sat behind them, broken, burnt, and hosed down. The largest pieces of structural steel were deposited off to the side, but 20-foot sections of I-beams and concrete boulders the size of cars arrived on the trucks. There were little things that had survived and big things that hadn't, and there was a sense of the miraculous and the what, the counter-miraculous? The steel head of a hammer seemed to be attached to a head of human hair, wavy, greasy, and gray, fanning out like an old-fashioned feather duster. What was this? I lifted it to show the mutant next to me, in the practiced pantomime of the deafening silent piles. Shoulder shrug. What? Pointing. This? It was a freakish crossbreed, half hammer, half wig. The goggle man lifted his mask to yell, "Fiberglass handle! Heat on fiberglass handle!" There was a lot of bones. There were yards and yards of fire hose. There was white metal from the hulls of the planes. There was a Toyota mashed flat. A lot of single shoes. There were all kinds of documents, some in perfect condition, from Cantor Fitzgerald, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Aon. I found the personnel file for an Irish Williams with a reprimand for being late in June 1992. I hoped Irish Williams was late on September 11th.
How long did you do this work, sifting through the rubble?
Well, we were there from September, I think, through February or March. March is when it closed down, I think. I think it was through February.
What was the hardest part of day after day, going to the landfill and looking for bones and remains?
No, I don't think there was so many parts that weren't hard. It was just an unreal scene, especially at first, where we'd work 12-hour tours. We'd either get there at dusk or at dawn, so you had these brilliant sunsets or sunrises. And Fresh Kills is this kind of man-made garbage mountain, this plateau that overlooks New York Harbor and Ground Zero, as it was just starting to be known then. And it was still burning. So it would be dusk, and you'd be on this trash mountain, and you'd look at the harbor, and you'd look at Statue of Liberty, and you'd look at the remains of the World Trade Center burning, and F-16s would be going through the sky, and it was always kind of windy there, and either this kind of gray dust always was whipped through, and you're in these Tyvek suits, these white cloths, these white suits and hard hats and goggles and masks, so we were all sort of looked like aliens and looking at this very alien scene. And then you would just grab a rake and move through the piles for 12 hours with these 5-gallon buckets next to you. And you would pick out something that looked like bone and you'd throw it in, or you might find a credit card, or you might find personnel files from, you know, Cantor Fitzgerald or any of these companies that were there that just were... You just knew this was ordinary life for a few weeks before.
How did you end up being assigned to this work?
Because it was a crime scene. What in Fresh Kills, all the rubble from Ground Zero was trucked out and deposited to be examined for primarily body parts, but also what other identifiables we called them. Initially, they talked about hoping to find the black box, but I... you stop hearing about that after a while. And this was a crime scene, and detectives are in charge of a crime scene.
As important as the work was, did you feel like that's what you should have been doing?
There were times, probably at 5 in the morning, on cold days, when you had been digging and digging and digging, and towards the end you found less and less, where you wondered if this was something that you had to be doing. But somebody had to, so you went ahead. You had all these great Salvation Army volunteers, too, who came up and ran the mess tents and so forth, and had all their Salisbury steaks and these kind of funny foods that I hadn't seen since my New York childhood, and all these casseroles and fun foods, and they were just such decent people, and they didn't have to be there either, so it was always nice to see them there, and you know, you shake it off and get a little bit of perspective.
You are one of several people in your family who became cops. Your great-grandfather was a cop. You have at least one uncle who was a cop. Your father was an FBI agent. Why do you think it's the kind of job that sometimes runs in families, that generations do it?
Well, an easy guess might be that fathers come home and tell stories about work. And they're certainly, I'm guessing they're better stories than, you know, from the accounting firm. I certainly grew up on cop stories, even though my father wouldn't have wanted me to become a cop. And with my great grandfather, that was more interesting, because he had, by his own choice, sort of cut off that, you know, family pipeline. He'd left my great grandmother, and that's why he was more of a villain in the family lore than the fact that he was pretty definitely not the most honest cop in the world. I mean, when he retired, he went to run a horse room in Jersey, so he was obviously not unfamiliar with the sporting life.
Let me ask you something about your father. You had actually asked for your family's Freedom of Information Act files, and your father, who worked for the FBI, had a pretty thick file. I think it was from that file that you learned that he was actually in a car accident and killed a woman. Something...
Yeah, he did.
It was an accident, but
yeah,
but he never mentioned that to you.
He never did, and that was certainly the most surprising thing in the files, that he had run a woman over in the early 1960s in a completely innocent accident from all appearances, but also a truly horrifying thing. I from the reports, is that he was driving up Broadway at, I believe, 256th Street, which is right near where I live, and a corner I've passed many, many times without thinking about it, and now I pass thinking about it, where he was driving up the street and an elderly couple was crossing, and a car speeding in the opposite direction made the woman jump back into the path of his car. And, you know, it was what was done was done. It was all reported and investigated. And but I asked my mother about it, and she said that he said it was just the most horrible thing. He didn't believe it was happening as it was happening. And I was interested in it just because, well, for a number of reasons. One, because it had been hidden from me. But my father was a Marine in the Second World War, and then he was a G-man for almost 30 years. And he had never killed anybody and never hurt anybody, as far as I knew. And these are the most exciting and dangerous-seeming jobs you could imagine. And yet he runs somebody over going home from work someday. And it just seemed odd and sad that it had happened.
Why do you think he never told you?
I don't know. I mean, if it was nothing to be ashamed of, and I have no reason to believe it is, I don't know why it wouldn't have found its way into some cautionary tale about driving safety. You know, I didn't drive at the time. I didn't get a license till I became a cop, so there was maybe no opportunity for it. I think he just felt terribly about it.
When you found out about the story, did it make you feel any more or less inclined to take risks at work, knowing that for your father, the worst tragedy happened just kind of driving home, not on the job?
Yeah, well, I don't think there was anything that I pulled back from out of fear. I mean, you know, you're careful and you're thorough in your preparations and you go where you have to go. But it does sort of incline you to the belief that a lot of stuff is out of your hands, which you have to make sure as much as possible can stay in your hands, as has to be in your hands, but a lot of it's out of them.
Let me ask you about your writing. I just want to say I think you really write terrifically. Your writing for The New Yorker was done under a pseudonym. I mean, for obvious reasons, you're a cop, and although you're not undercover, you don't need to give away your identity and give away the identities of the people who you work with in writing for a magazine. But your new book is not written under a pseudonym. You're a detective now. You're not doing street work like you were before. But are you afraid about how it might affect your work as a detective to have your name out there?
I wonder. Obviously, it's a decision I made, but it does concern me how it could affect my future police career, whether I'll be on the stand and the defense lawyer will cross-examine me about what I did for the story and if there's any discrepancy between a published version and a police paperwork version. And mostly it's to challenge my motives. Why am I here? Why have I done it? Why is he here? I mean, that's what defense lawyers do, and you have to be ready for it. But it's going to be a different cop life from now on, but I think I'll be able to manage it.
Do you want to have more of a writer's life than a cop's life in the near future?
Well, one of the nice things about working full-time as a cop was that the time that I got to write was really a privilege I had to fight for. I mean, I wasn't sitting home all day wondering how I'm going to fill this page. It was, thank God, I've got a free hour. I've got a free afternoon. Let me get to it. So you could think of work as the big procrastination from writing.
It's a lot of effort to procrastinate from writing.
Yeah.
So you're worried what would happen if you gave up the work and you're just facing the blank page?
Yeah. I mean, I like getting out a little bit every day.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Edward Conlin's new memoir is called Blue Blood.